Welcome, Photon Warriors. Commence strategic maneuvers at audible command signal. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, begin.
Jackalope Radio presents Movies Hate You. Movies Hate You, with your host, Rob Housechild.
And welcome back to the Movies Hate You show. Well, welcome back would mean they went away, Todd, right?
Welcome to the Movies Hate You show.
Oh, that's right. Our theme song, sung by Todd Sheets, our just great producer.
Thank you.
Just a great guy. Great all-around guy.
Thank you.
Check him out at Night Watch. Come on.
Thank you.
You know, he does this thing called Night Watch on Jackalope. You might have heard of it. But anyway, we are the Movies Hate You show, the only movie show on the Jackalope family of channels and stations and conglomerates and tall offices in the middle of big cities, right, Todd? Is that true?
No.
Well, the hell with you. We aim to be the first and only movie show on this station. And the hell with the rest of you. I'm just kidding. We can all share the same air. It's all right. Is my sidekick here tonight, Mr. Ree?
Hello.
Oh, there he is, Mr. Ree.
What else might be? What else
my paranormal sidekick. How are you, sir?
I'm paranormal.
I know you're quite a celebrity effer, and it's been a horrible, horrible week to be a celebrity because a few of them have left us for another plane of existence or just darkness for all eternity. And that would be, of course, Chief J. Strongbow, a childhood favorite. That bearded guy in the band, I don't know, they were all bearded, weren't they? One of those bearded guys in that hippie band. Mr. Jonathan Frid, we just lost. I'm assuming he watched Tim Burton's trailer for the Dark Shadows movie and keeled over in disgust and embarrassment.
I think he died just in time to spin in his grave.
I think they're going to have to get him in the grave first, and then he'll start spinning. You think he'll be spinning as they put him in the grave?
Good question. I don't know.
And if he's a vampire, shouldn't he still be alive?
Well, that's the thing. You got to cut off the head, guys. I mean, no disrespect, but you got to cut off his head.
How about a steak?
I'm a vegetarian, but thank you anyway.
Okay. But I meant, anyway, the hell with you, Mr. Ree. Lee Peterson, Mr. Ree, our returning sidekick and DVD reviewer, but there will be no movie DVD reviews this week, except for that little knock on the Dark Shadows reboot, remake, reimagining via Tim Burton. Did we lose anybody else? Didn't we lose the Phantom of the Paradise recently?
Well, Bill Finley, yes. Finley, Phantom of the Paradise. He was also in Toby Hooper's Eaten Alive.
Mm. Anybody else?
I like that movie. Did you mention LeVon Helm? Is that who you were talking about, the bearded guy?
Oh, yeah, the bearded guy from the hippie band.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, seriously, guys, all these people, no one under 40 even knows who we're talking about, and it doesn't matter. Let's talk about the living.
Dick Clark, you forgot to mention Dick Clark. He's a big one.
He can't be dead.
Dick Clark died. Well, okay. Then maybe it was Ryan Seacrest. We can help.
Oh, you're wishing death on Ryan Seacrest, who will take the Clark mantle, but not the riches, for sure.
Not a horrible death. Just you can die in his sleep. It's okay.
I thought it was kind of morbid that the guy, they would, you know, kind of wheel the guy out from a remote TV thing every New Year's, and he was trying to get the words out and everything. I don't know. It was. I don't know. It was kind of morbid to do that. Go out with some dignity. You know, I mean, the guy, you can't knock that guy's accomplishments. I mean, he was just. He has hands in so many things. I mean, rock and roll, would it exist without this man? Film Ventures International Pictures, would it exist without this man?
True. Did he ever make any horror films?
Yes, he did.
Hey, let's get back to the living for a second. Our special guest tonight, I think we just heard him pipe in.
I couldn't help it.
I know how attached you are to rock and roll, and we can talk about that.
It also happened to be a very good film, and I'm trying to remember the name. I think maybe it was The Darkness. Something about The Darkness. But I could be wrong, that he produced.
He did. I think there were three or four pieces that would fall into, I guess you'd say, the horror or cult genre. Not to mention stuff like the 25... $1,000 pyramid, every TV show you've ever watched.
I actually brushed shoulders with Dick Clark, because I was backstage at the $10,000 pyramid when I met Bill Shatner for the first time.
Awesome.
But wow. Introduce me. I'm going to introduce you.
I've got this. This is like a reverse interview. This is. I love it. It's so perfect for this show. With us tonight on the Movies Hate You show, sponsored by BMovie.com, is a publisher, film producer, exploitation actor, director. Wow, what else? So much, man. This man started publishing when he was 15, doing newsletters/zines. I don't know what they might have called it, newsletters back in the day, but we call them zines.
I remember zines. Yeah, they were mimeograph sheets, is what they were.
Yeah,
the ink got all over the house, and my mother banned me to the back porch, where the only thing there that I could remember, except for a clothesline, would have been an autographed photo that I had from like the age of 4 or 5 of Claire Bell the Clown.
Wow.
And I guess some people might say that I've been channeling him ever since. I don't know.
Oh, nice, nice.
Was that Bob Keeshan? Wasn't Bob Keeshan the Claire Bell? Am I getting that wrong? Bob Keeshan, Captain Kangaroo, was he Claire Bell?
I have no idea.
Don't stump our guests.
I'm just saying I think that's true.
To me, he will always be just Clarabelle. Honk, honk.
I mean, it's still a mystery to our listeners who our guest is. Maybe we should do it that way and have people
offer a free video, yeah.
That's right. We'll just do the whole show, and if you could guess who our guest was at the end of the show.
I'll give up my video collection, yeah.
Nice, nice. Well, you published your first book at 16. You've worked on over 30 different publications, magazines in the 70s and 80s, and we'll get into that with Myron Fass.
And now I'm doing your show.
And now you're doing now you've fallen down
I'm,
the ladder.
I'm ready to reinvent myself. Yeah.
You were a movie critic for Hustler in the heyday of adult pornography. You wrote for The Star and The Enquirer, trash magazines. What are called trash magazines? Some of that
Violent World. Violent,
Violent World. World. That was for Myron Fass, wasn't it?
No. Violent World was a different publisher. I can't remember exactly. Cavendish, I think his name was. He put out a few other publications. I think a couple of men's magazines. That's a long time ago. Actually, anybody who wants to know my career in pulp publishing, there's a very good site out there called badmags.com.
That's right.
That will give the whole inner sanctum of I wouldn't say that it was the heyday of pulps. It was the end of the heyday of pulps. I guess the pulps actually started when paper was invented or something like that.
Oh, yeah,
But we think of the pulps as, about the 40s, even though certainly before that even. The 40s and the 50s, and by the time the 60s rolled around, the magazines were getting a little bit glossier and less pulpish. And, of course, by the time I was doing the pulps, we were probably working for the only publishers that were still printing on newsprint. And some of the newsprint, when we say newsprint, I mean, we're talking bad pulp, but I worked for some publishers that printed on stuff that could not even be identified as coming from a tree or a I swear, there was one guy who published a couple of magazines, and they were digest-sized, and he would buy remnants of paper, you know, like get it real cheap. And I swear it was the same stuff that you would use as a shower curtain is made out of, you know, like glossy and slick and not pulpy at all. I mean, it was just, and then there was pink paper that another publisher would get real cheap because who wants to use pink paper, right? And then I did a magazine called Moped Action, and at the same time somebody else came out with another Moped Action, and I do believe mine was a little superior because the other Moped magazine was printed on something that reminded me either of brown wrapping paper or the stuff you find in the restrooms, you know, the brown coarse, I don't know what kind of paper, towel type paper. I mean, who's ever seen a magazine that printed on that, you know? And so are people calling in trying to guess who I am by now?
We're going to tell them who you are, and I'm not doing you justice because you've really dabbled in everything. You've dabbled in every possible genre, exploitation.
And some of the things I've dabbled in, I can't even talk about on the air.
Exactly. Some kind of under-the-counter stuff. We're talking, you know, B-movies, C-movies, A-movies. You've been on coast-to-coast with Art Bell
I've been on Regis Philbin. Show
Regis Philbin. I mean, you're a celebrity. To me, you're one of the last standing true New Yorkers.
Kind of the epitome, if that's the right word, of Times Square before it became Disneyfied.
Yes. Yeah, you touched all these different worlds through
your different
interests and your businesses.
And now I'm sitting here in my penthouse apartment.
Yes.
Lie.
On the Movies Hate You show.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you heard of. I mean, you know, it's all over the place. You know, it's a new thing, man.
Oh, well, sometimes I miss out on the... you know what? I usually get into stuff when it's not a new thing anymore. And that, of course, is what you shouldn't do. If you want to be successful in this world, you got to catch the wave just when it's starting out. Not when it's, you know, like dying out, I should say. You know.
Well, that brings me to what you're doing today. By the way, our guest is Timothy Green Beckley, who you may also know as Mr. UFO, maybe even Mr. Creepo. Google that name.
I think on your show they probably would know me as Mr. Creepo, but I'm sure if Todd is there, now there's got to be a big, there's got to be some crossover there.
There absolutely is.
Yeah, I know. I find that the paranormal people in general like movies. Science fiction people hate all of us. that has been my, of course, because they're top echelon, some of whom are now deceased in the world of the dust or wherever they might be. Of course, we're very skeptical and very anti-anything parapsychological. And I could never quite figure that out, but that's the way it goes. I mean, I remember one time we were holding a conference. It was a joint kind of like conspiracy, UFO, X-File conference. So this is out in Colorado. So the local X-File or science fiction group or something like that, the head person, a young lady, and she was interested in this. And I said, well, why don't you take over like a Sunday afternoon and do a special X-File panel and have some local authorities on that and discuss that? And it'll bring in an entirely different crowd. It brought in nobody. The people that were there for the UFO, the conspiracy, and the paranormal stuff fled. They had a much longer lunch. And nobody showed up who was science fiction because I guess they had been warned away by the spirit of Arthur C. Clarke or Isaac Asimov. So,
well, that's something I've seen also in kind of like the ongoing debate or animosity between Star Trek fans and Star Wars fans. is that Star Trek fans seem to resent the kind of spiritualism of Star Wars, and Star Wars fans seem to resent the kind of eggheadery of Star Trek, where it has to be something even remotely possible for them to buy it. Where in Star Wars, you can kind of bend reality and have people, you know, pushing you against a wall with just a hand gesture, you know, which wouldn't necessarily happen in Star Trek. Or maybe, I'm not an expert on either subject, but I don't recall there being too much of that kind of, you know, except maybe from a mind meld or something.
Well, I don't know why we all can't live in universal peace just like we were taught by the Space Brothers.
That's right. That's right. And why can't these things coexist? Why can't you, hey, I'm in the mood for a little Star Trek. I'm feeling a little more intellectual. And then, you know, maybe another time you're feeling a little more.
Play rod, right?
Yeah. Well, let's start at the beginning and kind of bring us up to where we are today, because today you are still publishing. You've got over 200 books to your credit. You have a publishing company. You just jumped into this ebook
thing, and you're doing that. And movies and all kinds of stuff coming out thanks to one of the greatest distributors. And I think the problem is that I get bored really easy. I mean, like even talking to you, I'm ready to go.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm going to let Todd and Mr. Ree take over, and I'm going to go take a leap.
No, it's true, though. I I've always just thought, well, even if I suck at something, and some people might say that I do, let me at least give it a shot. Maybe it's my way of curing the fear of doing something. You know, it's like when you're in grade school, and you have to get up in front of the class for the first time. I guess that's kind of the way I feel about it. It's like you got to kind of force your way to do it. And then sometimes you find out that you're really good at doing it, and other things you could figure like, well, just not put it on the tomorrow's resume, you know. And I guess I always felt that I've come somewhere, in between on all of this, you know. I've done some great work that I hope will live on to eternity, and I've done some stuff that I wish people will forgive me for. But that's okay.
Yeah. That's all right. Hey, you have to let it all live there and balance itself out.
My goodness, this is like Dr. Phil or something.
So when you sit down to write a book, what is your process? No.
It's to look at the page and figure out what to do next. Well, no, actually, what I do best, I'm a concept man. I can come up with a title and a blurb that will blow your socks off, and then I got to put the project together.
Then you have to go find the book to fill in the page.
And I do happen to have a team of very good freelance workers. You know, I've got my backup. I've got Tim Schwartz and Sean Castile and Maria DeAndrea, the world's second greatest psychic, because I think you have one there tonight. And I've got a team of people that I've worked with for a long time, and I met a lot of good writers over the years who are unappreciated by the masses from doing all these 30 different magazines. You know, I did magazines like Front Page Disasters and Rock and Roll something and Super Bowl and the soap opera this and that. And, you know, I don't think there's hardly a subject that I didn't touch upon, not because I was an expert on it, just because I could I knew the writers and I knew the formula and I knew how to do a magazine on the cheap. In fact, of course, as a freelancer, it's always a struggle kind of to get paid. And so I actually learned from these SOBs who you'd have to go fight tooth and nail to get $100 from. At least I found out, like Myron Fast that you mentioned, right? I mean, mm-hmm. At least I found out how to do everything for nothing. And today I think I've gone beyond the point where they were, because they had they didn't appreciate their audience. I mean, they kind of like Myron kind of sneered at everybody and couldn't give a hoot about anything. Yeah.
Now, in today, you know, anyone like, you know, now starting out writing, someone in their 20s, they can't really picture a time where you couldn't go, you know, on the internet and type in you know, Son of Sam,
yeah.
and then get every picture and every, you know, every description and blah, blah.
Yeah.
But you would put together a book like that, and let's in 1977, you'd go into the files, you'd go into your file cabinet.
See, also, put something too, I knew all these writers who were the editors of different publications around town. And these guys were really good. They could put together a magazine or a story or do almost anything. We had Art Crockett, and we had Bud Ampost. And, you know, I remember one time, John Lennon, after he passed away, we did two paperback books and a newspaper and a magazine special all in about 7 days.
Mm.
And what I did is I went in and got people who knew either the music business or who could rewrite real fast, and we put out some good books and things like that, you know. And, of course, I had talked to John Lennon on the phone. He was a big fan of the paranormal. And at that time, I was the publicist. Oh, that's something else I've done, too. I was a publicist, and I still consider myself a publicist, at least for my own authors and stuff. I recently had three of our authors on a coast-to-coast in a 10-day period. Well, that's probably unheard of, you know.
Wow.
But so I had clients like Peter Max and Les Paul. And so, you know, I don't know. I was out there. I was out there in a pretty grand style at that time. And it was, like you say, it was work. Today, you kind of just sit around and you can look up everything on the internet and just copy and paste.
Yeah.
But our files are extensive, and they go back, you know, like a half a century, I would guess. You know, I worked for Ray Palmer and corresponded with Richard Shaver. You know, I mean, I guess I knew some of the kingpins of that era, and I'm one of, you know, a handful that are still trogging along because others have given, you know, either retired or given up the ghost, so to speak, and I've never given up the ghost.
But those things you learned doing those down and dirty,
yes,
you know, cheapies and the exploitation,
yeah,
magazines.
Yeah.
You still are probably applying those, you know, same principles.
Oh, by all means. Now, I yes, yeah, absolutely. Well, there's many ways of doing it, I found, but you know, frankly, what I do, there's a heck of a lot of material and a heck of a lot of books that are in public domain or in some gray area there where, you know, all authors and people associated are deceased, and so who really cares? I can take the body of a text. Now, I did this recently with a book that was rather successful to us about haunted pet stories.
Nice.
And I updated the book. I got, you know, other people who are psychics today and who are involved in this. I changed the cover, put a nice fresh title on it, and it did okay. The book, you know, cost me a couple $100 to put together. But you got to do that now because you have to understand, like, back when I first started publishing and I was, there were 4,000 bookstores on our mailing list. That's down to just a handful. Yeah, it's speculation that maybe Barnes & Noble can't even hold out much longer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that only probably leaves Amazon.com, and there you got to compete with 2 million authors.
Yeah.
I don't know. Everybody is a writer now. I mean, everybody can get their book published for, you know, $69 or something like that. And some of them, I'm sure, are absolutely wonderful, probably better writers than I am. But how do you find out about a title? I mean, you know, suppose I'm a... You know, I've written a novel or I've written my first book on something. How do you get the word out? And that's what's become rather difficult because, first of all, you know, if your book is published by Madison Avenue, and I'm not terribly in favor of them because they had their day and they passed me by to a large extent. Every time I try to go big time with somebody like that, I end up getting screwed, to be honest with you, and waiting 2 years to get a book published, and when it came out, you know, it looked like a Dreck, and it read like Dreck, and it made me look like Dreck. Not Dracula, Dreck.
Dracula.
Dracula, yeah.
Well, the and I find the same thing in the movie business now, is that it's so cheap to make a movie. You could buy a camera, film something, edit it at home. You don't even have to leave the house. You can have a feature film made, and you've got hundreds of these movies coming out, and then you've got – those are the ones that are distributed, and then you've got a ton of other people putting them up on, you know, Create Space for Download and all these VOD sites and YouTube. And so you kind of don't know where to turn, and you're actually looking for someone to kind of filter this for you to say, hey, this is good. Now you've got hundreds of blogs out there. Half these people don't know how to write to save their life to give you an honest review.
You know what's the thing is here, though, and let's face it. You could be a band. You could be a book author. You could be a movie maker. And your stuff can be mediocre or totally suck, and you could still be popular. I mean, like, you can't go by that. I mean, it's like, who's good and who's bad? It's in the heart of the person, I guess, or the mind of the person reading or something. You know, I don't know.
Right,
there's a lot
right.
of people I look at and that I guess are, you know, popular writers or popular movie makers, and I don't enjoy the stuff. I can't say it's bad. It's just not what I would do, and it's not something that I'm too enthusiastic about, you know.
I'm not trying to discourage anyone from writing a book and getting it out
there. You couldn't anyway. I mean, maybe we should discourage a few people, but it isn't happening, you know. And it's like I've had some tasteless experiences with distributors and all, and even with a book and movie and so forth. And, you know, you think, well, why did so-and-so treat me like, dirt or something like that? Then you realize, well, heck, why should they placate to the creative end of it? Because they'll always find somebody who's coming along who's, like you say, got that camera, got that notebook full of notes, or can, to go somewhere and get their book published and pay for it and maybe even make a few dollars. And so why do they care whether they take care? See, I always felt just the opposite. I always wanted to find the people who I thought were talented and then utilize them, and pay them as well as you can. Certainly not very much in this type of stuff because we're not, operating on a very high level here. But some of the people who have worked on some of the projects, like my movie Driller, and I won't mention their name because they might be humiliated or embarrassed beyond belief, or maybe not. Again, I look back and there were a few people there who kind of started their career, and some of them have gone on to fame and glory and living in the Hollywood Hills, and
many people have. Started in adult films and gone that way, and even gone in reverse and worked, under pseudonyms while they were in both sides of the industry.
I always like to tell the story, and he's deceased now, so it doesn't matter. But Brother Theodore was a friend of mine. I would say I didn't know him intimately, but we hung in the same circles, and I enjoyed his raw brand of comedy. And I liked him so much that I wanted him to be the narrator of Driller, and he agreed that he would like to do that, or he was willing to do it for whatever I offered to pay, but he wouldn't let me use his name because he was a member of SAG, and therefore I guess he would not be entitled to benefits, or he would, you can't do that. You can't do porn, and you can't do. Stuff that's not the union, so
he was in some softcore Jaws ripoff called Gums,
called the Dr. Hook or something with a hook on it.
It was something called Gums that was a Jaws.
That's what I'm thinking.
Gums,
that must have been it. Well, let me Captain Hook or something. I don't know.
I think like an Ahab or something. Let me reverse that. You're talking about the movie you made in 1984 called Driller.
Yes.
And which is a triple X spoof, one of the first larger budgeted spoofs in the adult industry of Michael Jackson's Thriller, and it's just insane and wonderful and just it's bananas. But
banana,
long bananas. Long bananas, just spinning, drilling bananas.
There you go. It's just it is a crazy scene, And you know, I'm particularly proud of it. We had the actual first spurting girl, Esmeralda, in the movie, and now everybody hits the female G spot in their films. You know, and
but you had the first squirting girl, although Annie Sprinkle
probably did. Yes, and everybody thought it was fake. Well, now how ironic, because I think you know, 50% of the squirting girls in the movies today are fake, and mine was the real thing. See, but nobody believed it because, again, I was ahead of my time.
Now, do you mean fake in the sense that they're adding CGI to show the effect,
or they're just pissing? I know somebody, one of the reviewers said it was confetti. Now, I would like to know how confetti. Never mind. I don't know. Is this show for all ages?
we are clean. We can refer to stuff. We just don't use any bad words.
Yes, yes. Well, I'll refrain from saying bluff and drop down. I will do that. Just in honor of you and Ted Sheets.
Well,
yes.
Mr. Ree is a big Driller fan. He's also a huge Brother Theodore fan.
Uh-huh.
Did you know Brother Theodore was set to play the Vincent Price role from Thriller in Tim's Driller? Did you know that?
That's amazing. And you said he wouldn't let you use his name, which kind of defeats the purpose of using him, right?
Yes, because, I mean, exactly. And I didn't have a couple of I was down to my last $50 or something, and I didn't feel I could give him the money and not use his name. You see what I'm saying? But then on the other hand, he was afraid he was going to lose work, and I can't blame him that either, because the offers probably were not lined up outside his door at that point, if they
right.
ever were. You know?
But he was
a character. He was a character and certainly one of a kind. And, he always invited me down to his show. I think he played down on 13th Street here in Manhattan for a couple of years. And at one point, he actually wanted to manage him. But so did the amazing Randy, actually. You know, in fact, I shared an office with the amazing Randy on Fifth Avenue, although he didn't come in because he lived in Red Bank, New Jersey at the time. I like Brother Theodore. I had seen him on Jack Parr and heard him on Long John Neville. You know, that's kind of what I grew up on, listening to my transistor, radio late at night, and I'd get to school late, and everybody thought I was a dummy. I proved them wrong, so I hope I did anyway.
And when you say the amazing Randy, you're speaking of James Randy.
Right? Yeah, James Randy would be the boy. Yeah, he wasn't. Yeah, he was indeed. Many a time we walked through Times Square, and him telling me how he wanted to be the next Houdini, and I guess, to some extent, I don't know. He wanted to hang himself there in Times Square. I think that's a long time ago. It's 40 years. I don't know.
Now was he doing the demystifying stuff and trying to expose faith healers, Uri Geller?
Yeah, but here's the kicker on this. When Long John, of course, who was the first talk show host, and of course his big subject was the paranormal. When Long John got a better offer and he moved from WOR, where he had been for over a decade, to NBC, WOR needed a replacement. So who was Long John's replacement? Was the amazing Randy. Nobody knows that today. I don't think very few people realize that.
Did not know that.
No, I was a guest on the Amazing Randy show, and it was similar in format to the Long John show. I mean, he didn't talk paranormal every night, but he had on, I remember being on with Reverend Virginia Brazington and Alan Greenfield and Daniel DeCohen, and it was the same format. It was a panel, which I kind of missed. So I don't like this, a one-on-one, and there's only me and the, one other person talking. I like a little bit of irony and a little bit of discussion and a little banter back and forth, like we're kind of having tonight. I mean, everybody times as they go along. And
Todd fell asleep.
I'm right here.
Okay, well, I did that recently.
I heard, I think it might have even been on a Jackalope show, that there is a James Randi documentary coming about.
Well,
either being filmed or it's done. Yeah, that's maybe through this show, someone will hear it and they can reach out to you if they haven't finished it, because you might have some good additions for that film.
You know, I have nothing bad to say about Randy. I think you know, his paranormal stuff is anti paranormal stuff is just overblown. I from what I know of him and from hanging out a few times, I mean, he'd do anything to get a little bit of publicity and attention. But so do a lot of people. So, you know,
right.
Everybody stands on their own. If he feels that his main goal in life is to dispute other people's claims and they want to go before him, knowing what he has the ability to do and make them look like silly putty, well, that's his, you know.
Yeah, and that's, you know, what he fell into, and he, yeah, he ran with, yeah, it, like most of us do.
That's his flim-flam, so to speak. I mean, that was the
right
title of one of his books. I guess that's what he does, and he does it very well. And I've seen him do fairly interesting things that were not paranormal in nature. I'm trying to remember one time he was at a UFO conference that I did, not to speak, but just to hang out, you know. And he opened a book, or he gave me a book and told me to go, you know, like pick a page at random and go down to the third paragraph or something while he's not looking. And then 2 minutes later, he read the paragraph and he knew what I had seen, you know. But I knew Kreskin too. I mean, I was backstage a couple of times with Kreskin in a show called What's My Line. Now, doesn't that go back?
Yeah.
and Kreskin did a fairly interesting thing. We sat there and talked for about a half an hour, and of course, Kreskin believed that he could create UFO flaps or UFO sightings or make people see things. I don't know exactly what that was all about. He tried that once, I think, on Coast to Coast, and they banned him from the airways or something like that. I don't know. That was a kind of a gimmick, and I guess some people, you know, if you put enough, some people are going to go out and hallucinate it or imagine it or...
Right, it sounds like one of those, like, you know, you're a chicken dancing on the stage in front of all your friends. Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, we were backstage at What's My Line, and we were talking and so forth, and I think we were talking just about that for the Inquirer or something, because I was a stringer for them. And he said, well, when you get home, see if there isn't something like a peculiar. Okay, well, now, that's kind of a hint. What does that mean exactly? You know, is my fly down or something like that? Well, it turned out that my watch had advanced by an hour, and he never touched my watch or didn't touch me either, as far as that goes. Now, I thought to myself, well, you know, he told me look for something, right? Well, so you're looking for something. Maybe my watch was an hour off, although I don't think it was.
Could have been an hour off for,
you know,
days.
You could eventually, if you thought about that long enough, you could find something that you thought maybe was a little strange. I mean, that's one of my explanations. Either that, I mean, he seems to have some ability there to guess who's got the $10,000 check hidden under their chair or something like that. George, I knew George for many years. I haven't spoken to him recently, but he lived over there in East Orange, New Jersey. That's where he was from. You know,
it sounds like what they would call a cold read, like a John Edward or something, where I'm sensing a man who has died in your life, you know. Yeah, well, who doesn't have somebody who's died in your life the name John or something, you know, that's it.
There you go.
Can we turn back the clock a little bit? I'm very curious about how you turned your self-publishing into a writing and publishing career. As far as you did your first book at 16 after doing newsletters for a while and mimeographs, as you call them. And in fact, I went to a museum once in Washington, D.C. I forget which one, but they had these little mimeograph machines on display, and it turns out that cowboys used to make their own little fanzines, and I thought it was the most fascinating thing because I was doing a zine at the time.
I've used so many printing processes over the years that what we do today on our PC would back in 1970 would have cost $70,000 or $100,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
In those days, okay, I had a, I think IBM put this out, a device that looked like a big, heavy typewriter. And it had some kind of metallic ribbon that went through it. And if you wanted to justify the type, it had like a color wheel. It kind of reminded me of the piano when you were a kid. It had color keys on it or something. Mm-hmm. And you would set the color wheel according to whatever ramifications you needed, and the type would be justified, even though it looked a little bit jaggedy. And that thing cost about $6,000 or $7,000, and you could lease it, but it was fairly professional, you know, and so my newsletters looked a little bit better than your newsletters because we had justified type.
Right.
Well, now, if you were running, I was working for that time for a lady who had a newspaper called the Manhattan Gazette. It was like a weekly giveaway, like the Village Voice, you know, loaded with ads, and I wrote some of the articles and interviewed the Eric Van Daniken and Yuri Geller on their first trips in and stuff like that. Well, she had a $70,000 typesetting machine, which had some sort of tape that when you typed it out and the tape went through the machine and you ran it through again and it justified the type. I couldn't tell you the mechanics of it because it's a long, long time ago. But that was $70,000. That was the state of the art. The state of the art now is, what would you call it, maybe $200 if you wanted to go out and buy. I don't know, even less than that. It comes with your computer. I don't know. It's like, you know, you could do the same thing for Zip.
I mean, when you're talking about, you could write a book and then give it to, like, Amazon, and yes, you don't even have to ever touch a piece of paper.
That is true. We now have, out of our 260 books, we have about 70 titles on Kindle. It's not the process there. They need to ratify it somewhat, so that it becomes a little bit more user or uploader friendly. Because sometimes they will kick it back and say, "Well, there are aberrations in the book, and there's, you know, hanging chats, you know, stuff that's out of hyphenations in the middle of the page and stuff like that." Because it doesn't take, you know, like when you transfer from one format to the other, it's not seeing the same thing that you hope.
I've heard the same about movies. People sending their movies in and getting kickback, saying, "Oh, well, there's a couple of sound pops in the middle or something. You got to fix this."
Or sure.
Can you re-encode it? And I've heard some stories where people, all they do is just burn it again and send it, and then it's fine with the same problems.
Well,
it depends.
Yes,
depends
know,
who gets
maybe
it.
Maybe it is. Just this week alone, I've got two customers. One said he could not play both DVDs that he got from me. Well, that seems to be impossible. Maybe if he used the forward button, because it could be that it started, if I can recollect, on band 2, right, instead of band 1, because when you're transferring it over it from cassette tape, sometimes it just doesn't start immediately at the beginning, right? So
right.
You would think with a little foresight, maybe push the forward button and see if there's anything there.
Or could he just have an ancient machine?
Yes, well, that's what it's, he said. It, I think it was a combination of both things, because it said reading error. And I bet that when I get the thing and I shove it into my cheap little DVD player, which, of course, plays CDs, it will immediately play, because they usually do. And the same thing for the DVD, and we've talked about this as well. You know, I've got three DVD players, two of them play on, you know, two of them will play the DVD and the other one refuses to play it. But it's not always the same DVD player. I've had expensive DVD players that would not play the good DVDs. They would only play, you know, like stuff from the street and vice versa. So, you know, give me the old reel to reel. That's what I want.
The reel to reel. Give me a laser disc. Give me that damn laser disc. Plays every time. Let me pause for a second. You're listening to the Movies Hate You show. Our very, very, very special guest is Timothy Green Beckley, a.k.a. Mr. UFO, a.k.a. Mr. Creepo. Look him up. He is a wealth of entertainment, B-movie, exploitation, history.
I'm a bazaar.
He touches bazaar every day, and he's still in the business. He's made a business out of this since the time he's 16, and he's never looked back. And Mr. Ree, you had a question for Tim. You had told me earlier you were curious about a photograph or something.
Well, yeah, sure. Thanks for the segue. Excuse me, Tim. Well, I'm very interested in the Men in Black as far as UFO stuff. I mean that. Men in Black and cattle mutilations are the things that actually freak me out. As far as I think, well, maybe there really is something to this. Can't understand it. Now, you took a photograph that purports to be an authentic Man in Black, somebody who was following you, I think. And
Well, no, they were following a. They were standing in the doorway of a fellow researcher by the name of Jack Robinson. He had been a regular on the Long John, the show, and had been involved in a UFO wave in New Jersey as an investigator. There were some teenage boys who had seen some creatures. I forget whether they were tall or short or bumpy or lumpy or anything else, but they didn't belong down on terra firma here, and Jack was the investigator and taking notes. And it turned out, I guess they were doing an interview with the teenagers. I don't know, four of them, I think. Outside the park, maybe it was Paramus, I can't really remember. And a park across the street or down the block was a mysterious-looking black Cadillac, because that's what the men in black usually come in, or something of that mold, you know. And at one point during the interview, the windows in the Cadillac were rolled down, and they could see that there were figures inside who seemed to be gawking and looking and trying to perhaps telepathically read the minds of those having the conversations with the teenagers. Well, Jack, shortly after this incident took place in the interview, he found that his telephone was being bugged, and sometimes he would be having a conversation and a strange voice would appear on the line or he would get hung up on. He came home one day, his wife Marion, he came home one day and found that somebody had gone through their files, but nothing seemed to be missing, and nobody had forcibly entered the apartment. So now, Mary was a psychic to some degree. I mean, she had a lot of paranormal experiences, you know. I think she saw fairies in the trees outside her back of her apartment. They lived over in Jersey City. Now, Jack at that time worked in the at a bank, and he would take the PATH train over from New Jersey to New York every morning. And when his wife Mary went out to do the shopping, she claimed that she saw this figure standing in the doorway dressed like a typical man in black, you know, black hat, black suit, blah, blah, blah. Everybody knows that. They kind of look like the Blues Brothers. That's, in fact, Dan Aykroyd is a big UFO fan. I think that's where he got the dress up there in the movie. But anyway, she would call us. I was working with the UFO court jester Jim Moseley at the time. He had a magazine which he published on Fifth Avenue called Saucer News that I was managing editor. Anyway, we would get calls frequently from Mary saying that this figure would be standing in the doorway, apparently monitoring the activities of who was coming in and out of the apartment building where Jack and Mary lived. So we got kind of tired of listening to Mary, you know, tell us a story on the phone. And we didn't know whether she was yanking our chain or really there was somebody in the doorway. See, so we decided we're going to go over there early in the morning, like at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, when Jack had already left from work, but without letting Mary know that we're coming, right? This is our deep-rooted investigation. So we get in the car, and we get there, and true enough, now the street is, this is, I would say, rush hour, but it's a side street. Streets are kind of narrow there. They're not very wide in Jersey City, and people are double-parked going into the bakery to get their pastry, and there's a barber shop there. I can't even remember. They live on Palisade Avenue. Yeah. And anyway, so we slowed down because the cars are double-parked, and Jim Moseley handed me his camera, and I leaned halfway out the window, opening it first, and there was this figure in the doorway kind of standing back, so he wasn't standing, you know, on the step or anything. Kind of just hulking back there, hunkering down, we might say. And so I took the photograph, and I took a photograph of a black car parked in front of him or nearby. So we decided that we were going to confront this individual. So what we did was we drove around the corner. Now, it was, like I said, narrow streets, and Jim had a big old car, and we drove around. It maybe took about 6 or 7 minutes to get back to where we were. Well, the car was gone, and the strangely hunkered down figure in the doorway also vanished. Well, you could say, well, maybe he was there for some other reason, but kind of the peculiar thing was is that Mary and Jack claimed that they never saw the figure after that. So here are people being silenced by the men in black. I think I turned the tables on him. I silenced that little old guy, and he never showed back up in the neighborhood again. got frightened of Mr. UFO and Mr. Creepo and fled, wow. fled into some other time warp or something.
Did he? He opened the door and went to Yankee Stadium. Yeah,
you know, I don't know. Well, I think people ask me what do I think the Men in Black are, and I think that they are mind controlled zombies. That they are the agent of, I say extraterrestrials, but I don't believe that most UFOs are piloted by extraterrestrials. I believe they are piloted by ultra-terrestrials, things and energies and all that live here right alongside of us, but would rather keep their keep quiet their existence, because look at us, and who would want to exist coincide right alongside of humanity, right? So I think it's an interdimensional paranormal type of thing. What happens in a haunted house happens in a UFO landing or close encounter. And I have studied this before and have done a couple of books on this. What happened in the seance room back like in the 1800s and early 19th century, a lot of it is repeated in the UFO experiences of modern-day witnesses today. We just identify it as something else. And the energies behind these vehicles appeared in different forms and under different disguises. And anybody who wants a little bit of more information on that, they can get my book, Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer, because I do believe that some UFO beings are demonic, but not in demonic in the way that we think of demons in the Christian fundamentalist thing. I think of them more as the spirits, kind of a la Aleister Crowley and so forth.
Mm. That's a great segue. How can people, because we're running low on time, how can people get in touch with you?
Hours.
Well, it's spread out over 5 weeks. Yes, we have 5 hours.
Okay. How can they get in touch with
you? How can they buy your books, see what you're into, check out your films, let's send people to you?
If you wanted to, you just go to Amazon.com, and if you type in Timothy Beckley, I have made sure that even on books that I did not write, since I am the publisher and the editor, that if you type in my name, you'll get out of the 260 books, probably 140 of them will show up. We've published books by Brad Steiger, T. Lopsic Rampa, Commander X, Tim Schwartz, Sean Castile, Richard Sennett, The Ghost Hunter. We did a book on Lizzie Borden. Or if you want to get a free subscription to our publication, we put out a catalog about three times a year. We put it in the mail. We send it to you as a PDF file, so you get it both ways. We spare no expense. We give away a lot of CDs, a lot of DVDs. It's an unusual time you'll spend with us, but you'll enjoy it. You'll become educated, and you'll become a creepo a fan or something like that. But
awesome.
Go to
Thank you.
conspiracyjournal.com and sign up. There's a banner there. You can get a free subscription, and we'll have Carol, our friend Carol here, stuff some envelopes full of stuff for you and get it in the mail pretty quickly. And you'll read all this stuff. No matter what your opinion is, I'm not a censor. You know, we have a lot of different opinions, and people say, "Ooh, how can you believe all this stuff?" I said, "Why should I? I mean, I'm a book. I have two personalities here. I'm an investigator, and so I have opinions about stuff that I've investigated. But I'm also career-wise a publisher, so I pick books for various reasons. I pick books sometimes because the content I think is of importance." Even though there may not be few readers for it. Some of our most serious books are the ones that have sold the least, to be honest with you. So there you go.
So
anyway,
check them out. Conspiracy Journal.
Yeah.
Mr. Timothy Green Beckley, thank you for joining us at Movies Hate You.
This was so enjoyable.
Great. I hope you'll come back because we have tons of subjects.
I'll come back too. I'm not going anywhere.
And you can get us at movieshateyou@gmail.com. Check out bmovie.com, our sponsor. And please check out conspiracyjournal.com. Talk to Tim. Check out his books on Amazon.
Okay.
Type his name in. Google him. Mr. Reed, thank you for chiming in all night with us here. And Todd for producing this fine show.
Of course.
Yeah, good to finally talk to Todd after all this time here.
You should get on Night Watch. And let you guys touch base offline. I'll put you guys together and get you back on this show, get you on Night Watch, and get those books into the fans' hands.
My career is set for the next 5 years.
That's right. going to give you a show on Jackalope. I'm giving you a show right now. You got your own show.
Good. All right. Well,
Paranormal
we'll talk
Ecstasy.
Yeah, that's what it's there you go. We'll talk about it.
We'll talk soon.
All right.
Thank you, Tim. Thanks for coming on.
And spookiness. Bye.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for your time.